I'm Laura Harper Lake.
And I'm Sarah Reitzman, and you're listening to Creative Guts. Hello, listeners. Today's episode is being recorded in the world's nerdiest room. We're at Laura's house. We're sitting in the nerd chamber with Bob Brooks. He's a freelance writer, a game designer, a director, and a narrative designer.
Yes, and we're going to be talking about role-playing games, or RPGs as they're called, especially Pathfinder, video game designs that Bob has been involved with, the romantic comedy Bob produced in 2015, and balancing multiple creative projects with a full-time job. And for the record, the nerdy room is my husband's room primarily, though I spend quite a lot of time being a nerd in here as well, as my husband is also a GM, like Bob, which stands for Game Master.
It's very nerdy in here. You'll get to see it a little bit in the background of the selfie that we'll post to Facebook probably tomorrow.
I'm really looking forward to chatting with Bob because though I've known him for many, many years now, I feel like there's a lot of the history of how he got into what he does that I don't know. And it'll just be neat to hear that perspective from him because usually he's trying to kill me in a game.
I'm looking forward to this episode as somebody who knows next to nothing about role-playing games and has very little experience there. So hopefully I learn a lot from Bob.
Yeah, should be interesting. So please enjoy this episode with Bob Brooks. Thanks for being on the podcast, Bob.
You're welcome.
Why don't you start out by telling us what you do in creative fields?
Yeah, that's...
It's a lot, right?
I think my bio on Twitter covers it. It's like... writer, director, ditch digger, like whatever.
I happen to have that pulled up, so.
Careful what you read. Yeah, it's a little bit of everything. Predominantly, I work in tabletop RPGs. I do game design, world building, creative writing, that sort of stuff. For myself, I write fiction. I run tabletop games. Assistant directed movies in the past, a long time ago worked in the video game industry. I've kind of been a little bit of everywhere.
I've known you for, I don't know, 6-7 years now.
Yeah,
probably.
Yeah, around 7.
But I've known you as my GM.
Right.
For 3 years?
About that. No, actually, no, 4? Longer. We're going on two years
in this campaign?
In this one. So wow. Yeah, like 3 and change.
That's crazy. And it's been awesome.
Yeah. I'm glad.
Yeah.
You keep coming back. So I figure I'm doing something.
Yes,
right.
You are. So why don't you tell folks what Pathfinder is / tabletop RPGs? I think a lot of people have heard of D&D or Dungeons and Dragons, so they've got some basis, especially if you've seen Stranger Things.
Yeah.
If you want to give just kind of a quick synopsis of what that's like for folks that haven't played that or experienced it.
Yeah, sure. The thing it was sold to me as when I was younger was it's improv, but not terrible. So it's, you know, it's a bunch of people getting together, telling a collaborative story at its like bare bones. And then like, whatever you add on top of that, no matter what kind of game or system it is, you're adding a type of nuance in a way that story is told. I've seen games that are played entirely through like prompt cards, where it's just like there's a stacked deck of cards and someone pulls something out at random to change the tone or the narrative of a scene at random. There's no dice, there's no game master. It's just kind of a weird storytelling.
Interesting. Like,
technique. So tabletop games is just basically a little bit more gamifying that. You know, you've got mechanics, you've got classes, you've got stats. It's kind of like playing a video game, except you're not beholden to a specific creative's ideal. Mm-hmm. People starting out, sure, you can get like pre-written adventures. They're basically like a story that you can tell to someone else, and then they can affect things along the way. And one person is kind of arbitrating it and mediating it and kind of building the world that everyone else is playing in, and sets the suspension of disbelief and also the boundaries. So there's rules and stakes and everything kind of like comes together. And that's really all it is. Whatever else it becomes is what the people at the table bring to it. It's what they enjoy. It's what they want. Like, some groups of people get really into miniatures and like painting them and designing them. Like, there are entire games that are based around miniatures. Like Warhammer 40K is like, you know, you got a few $1,000s to spend and a few hours of dry brushing, like, go right ahead.
Jeff's all on top of that.
Exactly. And like, I've never really used them a lot, but everyone does what they enjoy. Mm-hmm. And like, that's really the great part of it. Like, you want to build like really cool, like three-dimensional terrain out of like foam and trees.
We've
and
done
stuff.
That too. Yeah.
It's cool. Like, there's so many ways that you can do these things. Like, you know, I go into building like little handwritten notes and like diagrams and like things that people find that's like someone wrote this like hand scrawled warning and it's like folded up and wrinkled. And I just kind of toss it across the table and they like hesitantly read it because they almost don't want to know what's written on it. You know, it's one of those things where once you know your audience, you know what to deliver to them. And as long as everyone's having fun, you're doing it right. There's no wrong way to play a tabletop game.
Yeah.
There's no wrong system. Pathfinder is kind of an offshoot of Dungeons & Dragons. Back in 2004, the owner of Dungeons & Dragons, Wizards of the Coast, and by proxy Hasbro, decided that they wanted to make a new edition of the game that would have been 4th edition. It was not great. By a lot of standards. There's some people who were appreciate what had happened. It was extremely simple. Everyone was kind of the same. There wasn't a lot of individuality. And when that came out, there was a little bit of pushback. But what created Pathfinder was that one of the things that made D&D really accessible at the time was that it could be published by any publishing company. While the identity of the product was owned by Wizards of the Coast, other publishers and writers could come in and make things for that system. They'd own their own intellectual property and they'd be able to use the chassis of the game to reach different audiences. The rules for 4th edition weren't given to other publishers in advance so they could prepare their products. And a lot of them had business models that relied on selling X amount of books a month.
Oh, wow.
So the company that created Pathfinder, Paizo Incorporated, they basically decided, well, if we can't have access to this, we're either going to go out of business or we're going to make our own thing. So they took the current edition of D&D and they kind of like, you know, put a fresh coat of paint on it. And that's what that was. And they've just done kind of a similar situation now. This year, they released the second edition of Pathfinder, which is a very different, very dramatically changed version of what people, you know, came to know. But they made the good step of making it available to other publishers in advance so that they could have, you know, their business model stay intact.
Right.
They didn't want to do to other people what was done to them.
Yeah. For my husband and I, you're the first GM that incorporated more than just a book, you know, like the visuals and the music and just the whole immersion of it, you know, your accents, just your narrative in general and your detail has just blown other GMs we've had out of the water. Maybe I shouldn't say that. If they happen to listen, I'll feel bad.
It's just one of those things you get better at doing as the more you do it. I started GMing and dating myself here, 1994.
You're so old.
I was like a freshman in high school. Like that's basically when I started doing it because none of my other friends wanted to. So I was like, well, this looks like fun. Like, let's do it. And I think about like 3 years in, I was like, man, I wish I could have music. So I went through the Herculean efforts of like getting cassette tapes and like using like a 2-tape deck, like stereo to record like the songs I wanted. And then I'd have to record them like 7 or 8 times so they could play in the background. And then every so often I'd be like, hold on guys, I got to pause. I got to rewind this track.
Oh my God.
And then like, or like, hold on, I have to find this track. And then we moved up eventually to like CDs and then eventually everything, you know, to streaming and whatever.
Now it's just awesome.
Yeah, it's super easy now. Like I can title tracks and I don't have to have like a giant folio of CDs with like a track list written in it. Yeah, I think one of my players still has like an old binder of game music that I had like compiled with like handwritten sleeve notes
and
stuff.
Like a time capsule.
It really is.
That's
it really
cool.
is. But like it's a performative hobby. Like you have to, you get what you bring out of it. So, or what you bring to the table. So like every little extra thing you do is just that. It's like, it's extra, but it adds a level of atmosphere. I remember like the first time I really GM'd for you. We were, of course, doing like a really atmospheric, like horror campaign.
Yes.
And I put on the first music and I saw you like start to sink into the couch and you gradually got sinker and sinkier and deeper into that couch.
I turtled.
You did. And then you were like, had like a blanket up toward your face.
It was so spooky. Whenever I explain it to people, I just say, imagine living in a movie that you can direct yourself, your character, and
like do basically 2 full days of tabletop gaming every weekend where I'm running stuff or playing. And then every so often my partner Hannah and I will do something like just spontaneously day of. She'll be like, oh, hey, let's do this campaign. Okay, cool. And me and her will run something. Right.
Yeah, I remember there was a time where you two were talking and it was like you were playing 4 or 5 days a week.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like in your vacation, that's what you did every night.
And exactly, Jeff
and
I were
like, that's awesome.
Yeah, when there's, it's our hobby. It's one of the things we love to do. So when we have free time, that's exactly what we do. And we're spending time with each other. We're actually like engaging each other in like something that's not just like watching TV or something more passive. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of fun.
It sounds like it's also a ton of work. How do you ever feel not motivated to do it? How do you sort of stay motivated?
Totally. It's one of those things like, you know, if I'm like sick or if I'm just not feeling good, like, you know, I'll be like, hey, I need a day, guys. But when I was younger, it was a lot of work to like build adventures and stories and keep it all straight in my head, because it's basically you're building an entire world, and to keep it consistent, you either have to write a lot of notes, which I'm terrible at, or just keep it all in your head, which is like what I just kind of did. And as I got older and as I got more proficient in it, it became easier and easier to juggle stuff and make things up off the cuff. So whenever I actually like sit down at my desk and work on something, it's something really involved or something really detailed that's like not currently, the game currently can't do. So I'll design something that fits into it, which is kind of how I got into freelance writing for Pathfinder.
Which is exactly what I wanted to ask about next. How did you start working for Paizo?
Yeah, that was right around 2013, I'm pretty sure. Paizo used to have a annual competition called RPG Superstar. They'd have people who weren't in the industry, and there'd be a multi-round kind of like game show style competition where they'd have rounds of like, okay, design a monster, and you'd be given a couple of criteria to meet, and they'd see how you could follow the rules, how creative it was, how well executed it was within the confines of the system itself. And they weren't looking for someone who could necessarily like rebuild the wheel. They were looking for someone who could follow instruction, someone who could, you know, be creative within a certain amount of confines, because they wanted things to be thematically consistent. They wanted things to be mechanically consistent. And I happened to, the whole situation was kind of interesting. I entered, and, you know, I think like hundreds of people entered the competition, and I didn't expect to win. And they announced the, I think there were 20 people out of that they picked for the first round. I wasn't in it. And I was at work, and I saw the list, and I they didn't pick me, and I'm like, well, you know, that's how it goes.
At least you tried, right?
I drove home and my phone blew up between the time I left work and the time I got home. It turns out one of the people they chose was disqualified because he had some published credits or something like that.
Oh.
And they wound up picking me in his place.
You were number 21.
Exactly. And I went on to be in the finals. And though I wasn't the one who got picked to write like an adventure for them out of the gate, it was enough to basically every finalist gets work.
Yeah.
And they gave me some work. Adam Daigle, who's now the lead developer at Paizo, he was the one who gave me my first real work. I designed a monster for the back of one of the Mummy's Mask adventure paths.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the Greater Sphinx, I think.
Oh, that's the next campaign that Jeff's going to be running for our table. Well, so I can't wait to see it.
There you go. When you get killed by that monster, just, you know, I'm
sorry.
Thanks
a lot, Bob. That's awesome. And so then did more work kind of come from that, and it snowballed, and were you working on bigger things eventually?
Yeah, yeah. So I worked on, I think I had that gig for Mummy's Mask, and then I think pretty close to after that, I might have had like a Pathfinder Society scenario, maybe one or two of those, and then I got pulled in to write on Occult Adventures, which was their big, like, I think like 2014 hardcover, mm-hmm. which is, it was just something that was really up my alley. It was really interesting. The topic was all like psychic magic and weird, you know, occult bullshit and like rituals and stuff. So it was really cool. And I loved like that aspect of it. I got to work with some authors that I really admired. And we had a great time of it. It was a very collaborative. It was a really excellent experience. And then because of the, I did like a massive amount of work on that project. I think I wrote something along the lines of like 15 or 20,000 words, wow. something like that. And then I went on to work on basically every hardcover they produced since then, except for I think the Adventurer's Guide, all the way up to the last first edition hardcover, Planar Adventures.
Yeah, so we have about, I'd say, 20 or 30 Pathfinder books, and your name's in a lot of them.
Yeah, yeah. I wound up doing a lot of player companions and campaign setting books, one adventure path. So I was around.
Yeah.
I was around.
Have you had Bob autograph any of them?
We should. That's... Didn't even think of that. But
that's one of the more surreal experiences that I ever had. So the publisher of Pathfinder has a convention in Seattle every year called PaizoCon. Usually happens in May. And I went there. I started going there once I started working for them. And the second year I went, once like my name was a little bit more well known, mm-hmm. I was like, it was right around when Occult Adventures was coming out. Like, people actually came up to me with books and were like, would you mind signing this? And I'm like, what? Who, what? Like, I was just dumbfounded, just absolutely dumbfounded. And yeah, that was a crazy experience. That was something that I had never really had any experience with before. Mm-hmm. And it still happens to this day. Like, I'll run into people. Like, I ran a game at Stairway to Heaven Comics in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, I don't know, like a year or so ago. Mm-hmm. And someone at the table was like, oh my God, I know who you are.
Yeah.
And oh yeah, I was in there a couple months ago, and I was looking through just what they had for tabletop books, and someone was like looking at a book, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's really good. You know, we get to talk, and he asks me my name, and he looks at the front of the book, and he's like,
Of course you think it's good.
Right. A little biased.
But it really is, so it's okay. And so at one point you did a Kickstarter and did a massive endeavor of releasing your own campaign setting, which was called Athera.
Yeah.
And it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. Even if you don't know anything about Pathfinder, look it up. Go to atherarpg.com, which I know because I helped design the website. So I have that in my brain. It is just the most stunning artwork, and I feel like you and all the partners and the team just developed such a beautiful product.
That was an experience that just, I'm still kind of amazed it happened at all.
Because you coordinated the whole thing. This was kind of your baby that you...
By and large, yeah. Like... The creative side behind it of like discussing how it was all going to look was a collaborative thing, but like actually like orchestrating everything was basically just me being out of my mind. Like the year before we did the Kickstarter, I was at PaizoCon and I pulled a couple of my author friends aside and I was like, all right, come up to my room. We're going to talk, sit down, like have a couple drinks, and I'm going to throw a crazy idea by you and see what you think. And I gave them basically the elevator pitch about what the setting was. Mm-hmm. I talked about like the cosmology, the planets, the visual style, how it was kind of like the 1940s in space. And at the time, like there was nothing like it in Pathfinder. Mm. They hadn't put out their Starfinder game yet, which is their like science fiction alternative.
Yeah.
And every reaction I got was, when can I get this? And when can I work on this? So I kind of came away from that being like, well, all right, maybe this isn't as, you know, wild of an idea as I expected. And I decided to look up, you know, how feasible is this? Like, you know, could I do this? And, you know, we put together a Kickstarter and managed to raise like, you know, $50,000+. And from a company who no one had ever heard of, an author that I hadn't done nearly as much when I did that. I had mm-hmm. done maybe like three books. And I pulled together a team of people that no one had ever heard of. Like I intentionally went out of my way to pull primarily authors who had never written anything before. Because mm-hmm. I'm like, if this goes through, if this works, this is your end of the industry.
Yeah.
And I reached out to people who just have a hard time in general getting into tabletop games or who didn't even think they could. And now they've all moved on to great stuff. Like every day I'll look on Facebook and they'll be like, oh, so-and-so's published a new book. And I'm like, I remember when they were first writing for me. And yeah. It's just a really great feeling to see them like go on to these really awesome things.
Yeah, it's sort of a launching pad for them.
Exactly. And that's kind of what I've done with every product I've released in that line, is try and pull people in who would benefit from the exposure, from mm-hmm. the experience, from the guidance. Because it's not just like I send out an email and I'm like, okay, write this. Here's the number of words you need to write, whatever. I send out, you know, an order for what I want, but then I kind of like guide them through the process. I give them some, you know, experience that I've achieved over the industry and in the system and in just like developing for game design. And I help kind of build their skills so that when they do move on to other publishers, those publishers go, oh, wow, this person really knows what they're talking about. They know how to follow the instructions. They know like what we need as a publisher. And pretty much everyone who's ever worked for me has gone on to do other stuff.
That's awesome. That's really cool to hear. Do you have any questions, Sarah, as someone who has not played a tabletop RPG before?
No.
That's okay. I've told her about it a bunch. And
yes, she has. Yeah. I have played an RPG, but it was Shadowrun, and it was okay.
Shadowrun's one of those things, like, it's interesting. It's also wicked weird. I mean, it's like, you've got, like, a cyberpunk aesthetic, but you've also got, like, elves and dwarves and stuff, and it's super weird. If you haven't really experienced it, it's take the Matrix and then, like, put a couple of trolls in it. It's...
yeah, it's, that's spot on.
It's really weird, and it's...
interesting.
It's also a system that's, like, at any moment, you could just explode. Like, that's basically how it is. Like, in Shadowrun, it's not like, oh, I've been in combat for 12 hours. I've taken, you know, 78 points of damage. I'll walk it off. It's like, oh, I got shot once. I'm dying. It's very realistic in that regard.
Yeah.
To a point of, like, you know, it's still a little science fiction-y. It's a little, you know, stretched in that.
As an outsider, it's interesting to hear from someone who knows that not all RPGs are the same.
Yeah, you think of just the variety in something like television or books, there's that many or more RPGs. I mean, there's everything. Anything you could imagine, it's been published in some way, shape, or form. It might not be made in the way you're expecting it to. Mm-hmm. There might be, you know, a desire or a need for something specific to be made. But for the most part, if you're looking for a genre, if you're looking for something that's like, there's a game called Blue Rose that's like basically nonviolent. Like, it, everything's solved through diplomacy and conversation. Like, it's a totally different kind of system. It's a totally different kind of game.
Not having any combat? Like, that's interesting.
I think there's... I'm not 100% familiar with it. I think there is, like, rules for it, but it's not, like, the purpose. It's not the point. And, yeah, there's something for everyone. There's something for everything. I mean, there's like, a Pathfinder version of My Little Pony. Like, there's literally everything. Whatever you want, whatever you need, someone's catering to it.
Wow. So you said you'd worked on some video game stuff?
Yeah.
I was just curious about that. I didn't know.
Yeah, this was a long, long time ago. So when I graduated high school, I had the aspiration of, you know, I'm going to go into art. I wanted to do illustration. I wanted to do concept design. And I was geared toward, you know, going into the video game industry. And right about the time I was graduating, I found an offer to work for a Malaysian company called German 3D, basically like right out of the gate. And I was like, well, I was thinking about college, but why not try this? So I didn't. And I took that.
Oh.
And I worked for them for a couple years on a game that never got published. They were a startup company. They had some management issues that wound up kind of like dissolving it from the top down. Mm-hmm. But we were, in 2003, we were basically a internet-based company. Like, everyone worked from their own country of residence, their own place of residence. We telecommuted. We had, you know, we had like basically online chats between all the different contributors. Like, there wasn't nearly as much software then as there is now. Like, there was no Skype. There was no real great voice options because not everyone had cable internet. Like, some people were still literally on like dial-up and DSL, like dark ages.
Yeah.
So we managed to make it work though. And that company wound up doing a wound up getting into E3. That's a huge trade expo in Los Angeles that happens every year, where major game companies and indie game companies get together and kind of showcase what they are doing and look for investors.
Yeah.
Since I was one of three, I think, people in North America, I got asked to go to E3. Now, I was supposed to go with the North American rep of the company who lived in Georgia, and we were going to basically demo the game together. We were developing an MMORPG back when World of Warcraft was brand new. So this was something that was like a really kind of like industry that was just coming into its own, a genre that was just coming into its own. And it was something I was really excited about. So fresh out of high school, I fly out to Los Angeles, and I get there and I call the guy, Kurt, that I was supposed to meet with, and I don't get a call. I don't get an answer, you know, but I we had cell phones, they were garbage, but you know, they worked. Reception was terrible. So, you know, I thought maybe it's that. So the day of the convention rolls around in the morning, and he was going to have my badge. He was going to have everything I needed to get in. I call him and there's no answer. So it's like 9:30 in the morning, and our meeting's at 11. So I call him again, and he answers, and he sounds a little distracted. And I'm like, hey, you know, where are you? I should come pick up my badge. He's like, I'm in Georgia still.
Oh, no.
So he apparently kind of came down with the not feeling wells is how he described it, which turned out to be a hot line of crap.
Oh, no.
But he was like, you're on your own. He's like, there's someone you can meet to get your badge. You're going to have to demo the whole game yourself to the investors. Now, you know, at this point, I'm 20 years old. I'd never done anything like this before. I had never been to E3, so I'm already kind of like starstruck.
That's huge, yeah.
And I get to the convention center. I get my badge. I go downstairs to the basement in Kentia Hall, where most of the indie developers were at the time. And I go into our little like cubicle about the size of the room we're doing this recording in now. And there's a flat screen TV set up. There's some computers set up. They're running the game. There's people in Malaysia who are like playing the game to showcase it. And there's two other companies that were going to demo their games. And I'm like, so I go to talk to the other folks, and I'm like, yeah, have any of you heard from Kurt? And they're like, no, he told us to expect you. And I'm like, So I'm basically thrown to the wolves on this.
Wow.
It turns out we were meeting with the company we were working with was making a deal with Microsoft or IBM as part of their Butterfly.net gaming infrastructure. It was basically cloud computing back before that was like a buzzword. Mm-hmm. They were going to make a distributed system where you could run games that couldn't run in your computer by distributing all the load to other computers. Our game was going to run on that. And we were demoing it for IBM, and we were demoing it for Cisco Systems. And the guy from Cisco who was there, I believe, had an interpreter, because he never said a word of English to me the entire time.
Wow.
He only spoke Japanese, and he had an interpreter, and I had to demo to him. So I had an hour I had to fill demoing this game, going over how it was created, what kind of market we were going for, what it was going to do, how it was innovating systems at the time. And I swear, if that game ever got made, it really would have been something special, because the things that we were doing with it, people didn't start trying to do for 5 or 6 years after that.
Oh, geez.
It was really ahead of its time, but I think it was also overly ambitious for the studio. We go through the whole meeting. I find out it's for like, I think like $1.5 million in funding. Like I didn't even know the figures.
Jeez.
It went really well. We got everything we needed, and I call up Kurt and I'm like, hey, good news. It went really well. Like, I think I actually pulled this off. And he's like, yeah. So we're breaking away from the company. And I'm like,
oh my God.
What? He's like, yeah, you know, there's some bad blood between me and the CEO in Malaysia. And he's like, there's some underhanded stuff going on. He's like, you know, we're just going to do our own thing. You know, we're going to take what we made, and he's going to take what he made, and we're just going to part ways.
What?
Come to find out years later, he basically stole the source code for the game.
Oh.
And screwed over Sherman. And it was awful. Like it was such a mess. And like, I didn't know how it actually had gone down. Like I blamed, you know, the CEO of the other company. I was mm-hmm. like, hey, you know, this isn't fair. We worked really hard for this. It turns out, you know, Kurt screwed him over. And the project and the company Kurt was working on just fell apart.
Yeah.
No one ever got paid. We were promised, you know, once we get funding, we'll get paid. You know, we're working toward this, you know, and I was basically spending every waking hour working on concept art for this and doing like system design for it and maintaining the design bible.
Wow.
And it never went anywhere. The product never shipped. It all fell apart. It was a huge disaster. And I'm probably misremembering, like, there's probably even more things that was like red flags about it. But this was a long, long time ago. But it always stuck with me. And I never really went back to the industry after that. Like, I spent so much time and effort and consideration in it. And then it all just kind of was for nothing. So I stepped away. But I learned a lot in it. I learned a lot of what not to do.
Yeah.
And not who not to trust. But I probably could have learned without that lesson.
Yeah. Did you feel like you kind of had things that you could apply to the other, you know, nerdy industries that you ended up working for that kind of, though it's different, it was the same?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the collaboration we did when we worked on that game, the kind of spirit of like everyone's got a voice, everyone can help in the design process. Mm-hmm. You know, there's admittedly at the end of the day a final arbiter who's going to say yes or no, this thing works, this thing doesn't work. But that was something that we decided, like, I decided I was going to take when I run a company, when I do something. And I took the stuff that worked and I dropped the stuff that didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really all you can do out of any situation.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like it'd be crazy not to ask you about this independent film that you directed. Romantic comedy, most likely.
That I have so many stories. So that movie is my friend Andrew Bemis's love child. Like, he wrote the script. It was his primary direction. And day of, he was also, because this was a small indie film. I was basically just offering to help produce it. I was going to handle some of the logistics behind the scenes. His partner, Jem, was going to handle the rest of it. And we got, you know, co-producer credit on the movie. And it was great. A whole awesome experience. And we were filming up, I think, near the White Mountains. And, it's in like late fall. It's really cold. You know, and we got this little Airbnb that we were going to film the whole movie in. It's supposed to be like a retreat for a wedding. And all these friends get together. And we get out there and we're going over the logistics. And Andy's like, yeah, since I'm in most of the scenes, I'm going to need you to, you know, help direct the stuff that I'm in. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to need you to tell me how to do that. So that was one of those, like, another one of those, like, get tossed into the fire kind of moments, but it was fun. And like, I was totally like game for it the entire time. And it was one of those things that once I started doing it, I wanted to do it again immediately.
Yeah.
And in that movie, like, we were also staying in that same Airbnb, mm-hmm. that little 2-bedroom Airbnb.
It was tiny. I saw the film.
We had a crew of, in total with all the actors, I think like maybe 15 or 20 people. So we were sleeping on the floor in the living room, stacked like cordwood, like head to toe with one another. And we would have like, you know, we'd get up at 6 a.m. and we'd go to bed at 2 a.m. or sometimes even later, you know, because we only had, I think it was like 4 or 5 days to film the entire movie. We had an amazing production crew, though. Like, our cinematographer, Amanda Grady, is just, she's outstanding. And she managed to make the single most stressful and terrible moment in the filming of that movie look like Hollywood gold.
Wow.
Like, so the climax of the movie is the wedding. Mm-hmm. And there's this montage that was to happen where everyone's lighting little paper lanterns and setting them out onto the lake. We had this amazing location shot set at this like beautiful lake with a huge escarpment like looming over it. It was just picturesque. It was windy as hell that day. It was also like 20 degrees, but the movie was supposed to take place in spring. So everyone had to like take off their jackets when we film. And I was like warming up people between takes and like trying to get them coffee and here's a big jacket, like stay warm. At sunset, we were going to release the lanterns. We had one day to do this and we had maybe an hour of the appropriate daylight. The wind was blowing back toward the shore.
Oh no.
So we'd light the lanterns and we'd try and send them out and they kept like blowing back in or sinking. They weren't like drifting out like they were supposed to. So there's all these shots of, we didn't even think we were filming at the time. The actor was just trying to get the props to work. So we're all standing on the shoreline and like everyone's trying to like light these little lanterns. They're all helping each other, trying to light them. They're putting them in the water. They're not like going out. There's one shot of one of the actors like pushing it with a stick, trying to get it out. And it managed to come together in the movie as this really beautiful, like, moment of, like, friendship. And, like, it's such a heartwarming scene. It's, like, my favorite part in the entire movie. And it's just, it's magic, but it was not scripted that way. But that was one of the beautiful parts of the movie is, like, there were so many moments that were either ad-libbed or in the moment as we were blocking the scene, we'd be like, oh, my God, yeah, do that. One of the actors, Kevin, there's a scene where... The characters come in from the outside from doing naked yoga, which I'll get back to. And he's in the house and they basically walk in on him. And he's supposed to be standing there having just gotten up in the morning. And he's supposed to just stand there and say his line. And then, you know, it cuts. So while we were discussing it, he starts swaying from side to side and just kind of like twisting. And his body language is really like weird. And... we were like, no, just do that. Actually, do that when we film. And we're like, here, take this bowl and smoke. Like, just act high. So they come in and he's just like swaying back and forth. He brings a bowl up. He takes a hit and he goes, hey, guys, like acting totally fine about this very like surreal situation. Because one of the big joke scenes we filmed, one of the good comedic moments was... The couple that was getting married was very like kind of new age and very like, you know, crystals and yoga and all that. And the main character, Beth, is kind of like caught between them. She goes out on the porch for her morning coffee and the two of them are out there doing like their dawn nude yoga. And so we have this shot where you just see the two nude actors from the butt. And then she's standing between them from the front with her coffee cup with a horrified look on her face. And then it basically cuts to her between the two of them, like very close. And they're like trying to get her to do yoga too. And it's a hilarious scene, but it was 20 degrees. So,
oh man.
And these two actors were just, they were champs. Like they're like, no, we'll as many takes as we need to, as many times as we have to do it. I'm like, you guys are going to get hypothermic and die. But it was, they were just amazing. And like, it was so much fun.
And one of those guys was Rory, right?
Yeah.
On our volleyball team, Rory. She's on the team with him. So.
Oh yeah. So ask him about his sock sometime.
I definitely will.
His modesty sock. We gave him a modesty sock. It fell off like every other take.
That's endearing.
That movie was such a great experience to work on. I worked on almost all of it. There's some shots that are filmed in Massachusetts that I wasn't there for, but everything that's at the house or at the lake, it was just a lot of fun. It was a great time.
Oh, where can we watch it?
It's on Amazon Prime. You can search for Most Likely and Rory Akers or Andrew Bemis, and you'll get it.
Yeah.
It's free if you have Prime.
Yeah, I saw it in Flagship Cinema in Derry, New Hampshire when it was opening. First released. Yeah.
Very cool.
It was really awesome.
Have you worked on other films or was it just that one?
It was basically just that one. I did help.
I acted in my film.
I acted in a student film for Laura. Yeah. I was playing her boss.
Yeah.
I think I had all of one line.
Yeah. He had a little speech about like, we don't know what's happening with the power, so you're going to go home and, you know, whatever. Yeah.
Are you on IMDb? This is very impressive.
I think I might be quoted in that for Most Likely.
For my film? Of course. Yeah. That never really like went out into the world much.
That was honestly so much fun though. Like
it was really fun.
I remember we were blocking that scene where Jeff's running or like walking and the two guys with like the stolen TVs go running by him. We were trying to get like the timing of it right.
Oh my god. And
yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Make a student film and you'll really get a huge appreciation for how hard it is to make a movie.
Oh, it's so much work.
It's so much work. It's so fun though. It's just another one of those things. If I had $1 billion, it would be another fun thing I would do all the time. You know, music, art, movies, like it'd be awesome.
It's amazing is Andrew and his partner, like they work full time, they have kids, and they managed to like block out time to like do, I don't know how they did it. Like they're scheduling champs.
Yeah.
Like they're scheduling champs, but they managed to make Most Likely on like the tightest of schedules. And like I think Andrew edited the entire thing himself.
Oh
like,
man.
On his computer. And the movie looks great. Like he did a fantastic job editing it. And man, I would have just fallen apart at the seams.
Yeah.
Like that's a lot of stress.
That is crazy.
Yeah, it's a hell of a thing. Don't watch it with your parents.
Yeah.
The opening is not safe for work.
Unfortunately,
or do watch it with your parents. Maybe have, you know, a conversation about that.
It's up to you, but you've been warned.
Laura's student film didn't make it to your IMDb, but most likely is right there with a producer credit.
That's awesome.
Very cool. Well, we need to go in and is it like Wiki where you can just edit it? We'll just
I've never actually tried.
We'll add there's the
a
fall.
There's a big edit page button, and I'm tempted to hit it and don't, do whatever no. I want. Don't.
Let's not bring his name down. The student film. Can you talk to us about what it's? You touched upon it with Athera managing a lot of creatives. Can you talk about collaboration and how you've had a lot of success with it, and maybe some challenges that you've had with it, and like what you've had to do to work with different creatives? Because a lot of times when you come together with someone else, hopefully it's seamless, but sometimes there might be friction or different viewpoints on how you want something to turn out. So how does that work when you're collaborating, especially on bigger projects?
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, that happens all the time. Even going back to just like the movie, like we were having a great time on it, but there were definitely like on-set arguments that we had.
Really?
About like scheduling, about like, you know, lunch, just little stuff. Yeah. Like, you know, you pack people into a house for a long enough amount of time and it's going to get real world, real, real fast. So like it happens. And in like the tabletop industry, collaborating with a large group of people is one of those things where everyone has to be on board. Everyone has to kind of understand where they fit in the process, and everyone has to be like willing to accept that. Mm-hmm. And when they don't, or when there's like ego involved or something, it can really break apart. And sometimes the product suffers for it. There were some products, I'm not going to name them, that I worked on where we were giving feedback about something that was being made, and we're like, hey, this doesn't work. It looks good on paper, but in actual play, this is not really going to hold up. This might not be like interesting to people who are playing it, or this just might not work as you think it will or as intended. And that's one of those instances where, unlike on Occult Adventures, where everything was very like, oh yeah, very collaborative, very understanding, there was a little bit more ego, a little bit more contention, a little bit more daddy knows best kind of like mindset. Mm. What came out of it wasn't as good as it could have been. There were some missed opportunities. There were definitely some things they wound up having to fix in post effectively, like the erratas that had to come out to like make things work a little bit better.
Yeah.
And it was concerns that were addressed in the creation of it. And that can happen too with like people you have on your that are subordinate to you, who are working for you. I mean, sometimes life happens, people don't show up. I had a comic book artist that I hired. I paid 50% in advance for, you know, some comic pages to be done for the next one of the next Athera books. They got like halfway through the process. They had drafts for every page. And then like they had some serious family issues come up, and they were like, can I get an extension on this? And I'm like, oh, absolutely. You know, like some serious stuff is going on, but they never got around to it. They never finished it. And it basically just fell apart, and I was left holding the bag on it. So that also happens with writers. Like, you know, they commit to something, they overcommit. They're like, I can't finish this. You have to be ready for that. Mm-hmm. And that has to be a learning experience for the writer, as well as the person who's doing all the developing work on it, of like, you know, now you know what this person's limits are.
Yeah.
And to try and not hold it against them, because, you know, shit happens. Like, life happens to people, you know, everyone's going to have a bad day. Give people a second chance. By the third chance, you should probably see that it's just a pattern.
Yeah.
But hopefully it doesn't get that far.
Yeah.
What is your like day-to-day look like? It sounds like your career is pretty piecemeal.
So I wish this was my full day job. So I work as a assistant to a transaction coordinator for real estate in my like day-to-day life. So my Monday through Friday is working for like an excellent boss who also happens to be a gigantic nerd.
Yay!
Shout out to Hannah Brooks in the leverage department. Like, she's also one not related to me, even though we have the same last name, which was really weird.
And her first name is Hannah,
which is extra weird because that's also my partner's name.
Yeah.
So
that's all very confusing.
It's incredibly confusing, especially for me, because now I have to differentiate Hannah's. And the other person she has working for is also named Hannah. So
there's
a proliferation of Hannahs in that.
Yeah.
But we found out very quickly working together that we have very similar interests. We have very similar like personalities, and that's great. So my 9 to 5 is that. And then I prior to the last few months, it's just been, you know, whatever I feel like doing. You know, I'll work for a couple hours on this. I'll work for a couple hours on that. It'll be, you know, professional, personal, like I'll play a video game. I'll watch some TV, you know, whatever. I've been trying to like make sure I do some work on my professional projects every so often, because like if I let it slide, I'm only accountable to myself, really.
Yeah.
And like my publisher, Jason, but he's like super understanding. So like things slide.
Yeah.
So I've been kind of like actually like scheduling, like, okay, this is an hour. You're going to do whatever you can do in an hour. And who knew I actually got stuff done?
Whoa, it worked.
Yeah. So, you know, there's more stuff that's actually like nearly finished and, you know, will be coming out, and that's cool. And then, you know, I still work on stuff for like my weekend games with like everyone that I play with, everyone that I GM with. You know, I'm making like art and maps and references and handouts, or I'm just writing something for my own personal enjoyment. And, you know, and then watching TV, hanging out with Hannah, like.
Yeah. Cool. So you're busy.
Every day's got something going on. It's funny. I was trying to schedule with a friend who does this nerd improv stuff called Dorks and Dungeons. I was trying to schedule like a Friday to hang out with him, and we both have like super busy schedules. He's like, all right, so what about the fifth Friday from, I'm like, I got something going on that day.
Oh my God.
So we've been pushing that around. I think we finally nailed a date down so we can actually like hang out. But yeah, it can be a lot to juggle, but you know, I enjoy every minute of it. Like, yeah. I really love the job I have right now. I love my hobby. I love everything about it. One of the things I had to learn was don't do something that you don't enjoy if you don't have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't work at a job that makes you miserable. Like, even if you have to like make some sacrifices, if you can manage it, if you can actually like afford to make those sacrifices, and that's something that's like personal to you and that you can do, do it. Earlier this year, I got laid off from the insurance industry job I worked in, and it was like the best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah.
My first month out of there, I was like, oh man, this is great. Like, I'm not under a super amount of stress anymore, and I don't feel like I hate myself. Holy crap. And then I got a great new job.
Yeah. It
pays better than I was making before, and everything's excellent.
Just kind of fell into place.
I was lucky in that regard, but like, you know, if you can make it work, if you can find a way to not have to like suffer, then don't. Life's too short. And I mean, that's not everyone has that opportunity, but if you can, mm-hmm. try.
That is something that you can't put a price tag on, but it really, if you wake up in the morning and not dread what you have to go to do.
Yeah. Like your time is valuable.
And it's interesting sometimes how we either desensitize ourselves or like live in a state of denial where we don't realize how miserable we are until we get out of it. And we're like, oh my gosh, I feel so much better. I had no idea I could be happy.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's one of those things where like, if you're in an environment where your time is being monopolized and you're going to have to constantly like spend your own energy to like account for other people, and it's not productive and it's not healthy, you have to try and find a way to get away from that.
Yeah. And if you can find a way to be creative when you do that, you can go into a new creative field or something, or, you know, that's even better. So probably rapid fire.
Is it rapid fire time?
Yeah.
Oh God, what's this?
Buckle up, Bob. You're about to go into rapid fire questions.
Oh no.
Which are historically not too rapid, but we'll try our best. We're going to throw questions at you, a whole big mix of things, nerdy and non-nerdy.
Okay.
And you know, try to be as simple as you can, but if you go on and on, we'll edit it down or just let you go. I threw some nerdy ones in, and I actually have a couple more off the top of my head, I think, but
wonderful.
Yeah. Worst job you ever took when art didn't pay the bills.
Oh man. Oh, I have a great appreciation for people who can work in the food industry, because I absolutely 100% cannot. I worked as a dishwasher at a seafood restaurant on the Nubble in York, Maine during like summer.
Ooh.
It was the worst experience of my entire life. And I was 19. Ever since then, I have been like, oh, you need a tip? Yeah, you're getting like 50%.
Yeah.
Like I've become like such a generous tipper, because it's just, I know how hard it is.
It can be murder.
Yeah. It is. Tough. I feel like everyone needs to do it once, so they have an understanding of like the pressure that food service and like anyone who client facing is like experiencing. Mm-hmm. So they aren't mean. Barbara asking for the manager, you know, like just don't like. It's hard enough as it is.
It is.
Toward the end of my like 5 years at Merkabasket back in the day, I was a And I sort of knew it. And I was like, I should probably leave and like let some new chipper, like not jaded, you know, fresh faced kid take over.
See what I mean by rapid fire and how it's not really
super rapid.
Other artists that have influenced you.
Oh, geez. Wow.
I know that's tough.
That's a tough
probably
one.
Probably a lot.
That's like asking someone their favorite movie. It's like, come on, that's not easy.
We've asked that before.
That, if that's up there, I'm going to start.
It's not on this list.
I'm sneaking it in there.
There's a couple of different fields of like artists and creatives that like I can really appreciate and like I really respect. One of the my like childhood memories is playing like Mario Brothers. I've always admired Shigeru Miyamoto, the guy who created Mario. And I got the opportunity to meet him at E3 when I was there. Like I shook his hand and I went into a little tiny nerd coma.
Oh my gosh.
It was amazing. And he had on like silver reflective fish scale pants, I think. Like it was a thing. And like that was really interesting because he was just such a positive influence in the industry. Like that's one of those things that like someone who can bring like something awesome that people can like have all these fond memories for, but is also just a force for like good. Like that's really something else.
Yeah. It's very respectable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm sure there's like a million other, like, as soon as you ask me that, I'm just like, I don't know.
I was just thinking that too. Like if someone asked me that would be very tough just to come, you know, but if you looked at, you know, who you follow on Instagram, you'd probably like find like 7 dozen, you're like, mm-hmm. Oh, this one and this one and this one. So
yeah,
I totally get that. These ones are super rapid. We require one or two words only for these couple coming up. Favorite color?
Oh, teal.
Great color.
That's the color of her company's logo.
I love teal. It's my brand color.
Yeah. Teal's awesome.
Favorite scent?
Favorite scent? Like citrus, anything citrus, orange, lemon, whatever.
Nice. Favorite sound?
Favorite the rain. Absolutely 100%
rain.
That's
great.
Favorite texture to... I always have to do this hand motion. I know you guys can't see me, but
she's basically making the cat needing a blanket gesture for those listening at home. I think like glass actually.
Oh really?
Yeah, I really like glass.
That's very intriguing.
Yeah, smooth.
Are you
solid.
Like a Batman villain, like like ding ding, like knocking a ring on a glass?
If the last 4 days have proven anything with bats invading my house,
oh
I'm
my
actually
gosh.
Batman.
Yes.
So
he had a bunch of bats come in.
I was just reading about it on Twitter.
Yeah, I shouted a lot about that on Twitter.
Most inspiring location you've traveled to?
Oh wow. Honestly, I think the Pacific Northwest, Seattle's really an amazing city.
Yeah.
And just Washington State's amazing. Like, there's very few places in the U.S. you can go where you can go from a city to a waterfall to a subtropical rainforest to, like, redwoods to mountains, then go skiing and then fall in the ocean all at once. Like, it's an amazing place. It's terrifying that it's basically sitting on top of a giant volcano, but mm-hmm. it's,
Other
you know.
Other than that, you get past that.
And I'm nodding vigorously.
All right. Favorite character that you've played?
That I've played?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I know that's really hard, but like, what was their build? Like,
Yeah. So, geez, I'm gonna be a little bit of a cheat on this one, and it's gonna be an NPC that was in a campaign, and I gotta say and you're gonna know it because it's Amos.
Amos, so, I knew you were gonna say it.
So I, in the last campaign I ran with them, it was this kind of untrustworthy, slightly alcoholic, murderous, morally questionable person who kind of like actually wasn't as bad as everyone perceived him as. And he kind of presented that outward persona to drive people away because he was like super insecure. And like over the course of the campaign, they learned a lot about him, that it was basically just like pushing people away, and that he wasn't the one who did a lot of the things that were ascribed to him. He hadn't committed all the crimes they thought he had, but he was just kind of like a foul-mouthed, always looking for booze, just somebody's uncle. Like, and he's just so much fun, and I can basically just switch into him at any minute. Like, it just,
you have the Amos voice.
It's just a deeper octave than mine and peppered with profanity.
Yeah.
You know, he uses like a comma, and that's basically like his whole deal. And Like,
I love Amos. I hated him when he first got introduced into our game. We were at odds all the time. I just was like, this guy is trouble. He's absolute trouble. And then by the end, you're like, oh, give me a hug.
He would that character would provoke her on purpose just to like make her like him less, because that was his deal. Like, he didn't want friends or attachments. Mm-hmm. And once he like got like understood that about himself and got through it, like, he became a much better person. And it was a really interesting arc for him. But it's really fun to explore that attitude, because at his core, he still doesn't really like... He's still kind of that same foul-mouthed, slightly alcoholic uncle, but like he means really well, and he's just like that lovable rogue character.
Absolutely. So that's funny. You picked an NPC, not a PC.
Yeah, I don't get to play him very much.
I know. That's a bummer.
Yeah.
Will you please tell our listeners what that means?
So PC is a player character. So like, if I make up a character and I play him or her, and an NPC is a non-player character. So
it's someone that the game master runs. So the person who's facilitating it. So you imagine that the players are like the main characters in a movie, and everyone else is an NPC. They're someone who's basically there to fill a role in the plot or fulfill a narrative purpose, or to just be a pain.
Yeah.
And that's who Amos was, but I have a soft spot for him.
He was awesome. Oh my God. That is my favorite campaign of all time. And I haven't played too many, but that's also my favorite character, Morwen. The character I played was this like bounty hunter, tough chick. I kind of based her off of Xena Warrior Princess a little bit. Like, just this like really hardened but soft interior Undine, who could shoot water and blood from her hands and like do a lot of crazy.
Wow, that was really rapid. Feel like you can take a little bit more time if you want.
Well, what's the best campaign you've ever ran?
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
Honestly, like, I've run so many. I think I'm going to go with one that actually completed. So between the years of 2002, I think, and 2007, I ran basically an interconnected series of campaigns. I mean, this was a period in time where I was gaming like 3 times a week.
Wow.
And I was GMing 3 times a week because, you know, I was young. I didn't have a job. I had free time, you know? And it was one of those things, you know, where we told multiple stories that all were a part of a larger meta arc. And then eventually it all came together. All of the characters came together. Everyone kind of like converged on this one narrative locus. And it completed a very whole story from beginning to end. It was kind of like it was basically the only thing I can think of as equivalent is like the entire arc of Marvel movies from Iron Man to Avengers Endgame. Like, they are all their own independent separate stories, but then eventually everybody meets up in one spot at the end.
Wow.
And that was really effectively what it was. And I'll never forget the moment when, because I use a lot of music in my game, like we talked about, and I'll never forget like when I played that last song in the closing, like everything was ending and just like the look on everyone's face when like they knew it was finally over and the sense of like years of work going into it and it finally being complete. Like, it's a really exciting feeling.
It's hard to explain for folks who don't play it. Like, I mean, I cried during this game.
I made her cry.
He made me cry multiple times in like my player experiencing or learning something very traumatic or amazing about her heritage or something, or just in like finding about the abuse of like Chloe and, you know, other characters.
Like, the characters suffering like great traumas and tragedies, you know, it was a very psychological horror. And there were moments where like she was either like just genuinely afraid and freaked out.
Yeah.
And then there were moments where it was like actual like emotion. And that's the great thing about like tabletop games is with the right person running it in the right atmosphere. Like, if you have no distractions around and the only thing you have to focus on is the game, like, people just get their cell phones away. People are like engaged and actually like willing to give it a shot. You'll get pulled in so fast, you kind of forget that the game's happening. It's like reading a good book. You stop reading the words, you start hearing the characters' voices in your head, and you start feeling the descriptions of things. You start like being able to envision like the texture of walls or like the smells in the air. And then you start getting into your character's headspace, and that's when you can empathize, and that's when you start feeling fear. And mm-hmm. with the right environmental controls like lighting and music and atmosphere, you can really sell it and you can actually make someone just really fully experience the whole range of emotion.
Absolutely. If you are very empathetic, which I suffer from, I will say, in the most recent campaign, you lectured me as Megara, and I knew it was just a game, but I was so mad. And I was like, legit, I had to like step back and be like, I'm not really mad at Bob, but I'm mad. You don't lecture me. Like, it felt so fierce and real. And that's like how easy you can get sucked in and just feel it. It's like living your movie.
Yeah. It's one of those moments where like you can experience an emotion so intensely. And then you have to realize like, oh, I'm not mad at the person who's running this. I'm mad at the, like, yeah. I'm mad at the story.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's what a good movie or any good book does. Cool. You know, if you've ever like thrown a book across the room because something happened in it, yeah. like that's that moment. You just want to throw the whole living room across the yeah. room.
It sounds like maybe the answer is that it takes a really good GM, but like, what's the difference between a game that engages you and pulls you in like that and a game that doesn't?
It can fall on the GM. The players also have to really be willing to get into it. Like, if you have people who, like, everyone agrees on the tone, they agree on like what kind of story they want to tell. And if there's no consensus, it's not going to be coherent. And you're going to have like one guy over here being kind of weird and goofy. You're going to have someone over here trying to tell a serious story. And then you're going to have someone else on their phone. And like it falls apart because not everyone's in. But when you have everyone in consensus, when everyone's in agreement, and when everyone understands this is the experience we want, and then you've got someone who has the experience to run it and tell a story, there'll be different levels of engagement with it. And you only get better over time. Mm-hmm. The more you practice, the more you play, the more you like kind of watch your players, listen, and kind of understand what they like, what they don't like, you know, what they'll accept, what they won't accept. And then you just roll with that and you tell a story that's interesting and they will bring everything else. A lot of times, like, I'll come up with something in a story and I'll be like, haha, I'm brilliant. And then they'll say something like, man, I think it's this. And I look at my notes and I'm like, well, it is now, you know, like, that's the beauty of it is like, oh, that, you know, as long as there's an internal consistency and whatever they came up with still makes sense. There's times where I'm like, oh, that's so much better than what I had. I'm just going to scratch this out and write the butler did it. Yeah. And as long as all the connective pieces still go to the butler, it doesn't matter that it was originally the groundskeeper,
yeah.
you know, and seasoned GMs can do that kind of stuff on the fly. Like you've had to adapt and stuff.
Yeah.
And people who are newer at it, like, you learn it. You'll eventually, like, pick up those skills.
Is there an aspect of, like, I don't want to say stage fright, but sort of, like, performance anxiety for the players?
Oh, totally, totally. Like, everyone who yep. starts new has to, it's hard because you're being vulnerable. You're leaving yourself open. Like, you're doing something that you've probably never done before unless you have like improv experience or something. Like, you're taking on the role of another person and you're acting it out in front of a group of other people. It mm-hmm. sounds like a nightmare, you know? Like,
it can be really scary. And mm-hmm. to what you were saying about the tone of the table, if you don't have that right chemistry, like, I mm-hmm. was playing at a table one time where someone kind of made fun of me and they're like, what is this feel good Disney? Like, they were not, they like made a joke. It was a joke, but it was definitely saying like, you're yeah. being too sensitive and vulnerable, you know, and I was talking about like the past of my character or something. Mm-hmm. And it was like, he just wanted a jokey, fun, silly thing. And that's hard to then bounce back and like, well, I'm going to keep role playing as hard as I can. You
exactly.
know?
It's one of those experiences where like everyone has to be like, has to trust one another. So it can be hard. And there's ways to approach people who, you know, may not feel comfortable being all in. There's some people who are better at like, you know, not always being the center of attention. You know, it doesn't always have to be Shakespearean theater all the time. Yeah. You know, sometimes you can pull that back. Sometimes you have to pull that back. And it's one of those things where once you learn the comfort zones of your players and you find out what they really enjoy, you'll be able to do something that works for them.
If you could go back in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
Oh, damn. Wow. That's a mean question to ask. I mean, 50% of me is like, go to college, but the other 50% of me is like, you've come this far without a degree, so what the hell ever, you know?
Yeah.
Wow, that's really tough. Honestly, I think the biggest advice and the thing that I had to work the hardest on was don't give a shit about what anyone else thinks mm-hmm. about like who you are as like, you know, your style or your attitude. Just like, be yourself. Don't try and conform to what other people want. And it took me a long time to realize that and to like accept myself and to just kind of like be whatever. And like, that's super hard. Like, I was like the weird kid in high school who was like, you know, in the black trench coat, and I had like dyed my hair, and I was like so goth I farted bats. Like, it was just...
Now they're coming back to you.
Exactly. Ah, they're coming home to roost. Ah. It was just one of those things of just like being able to accept yourself.
Yeah.
And just like, that would be my advice, is just be yourself.
That's great. Yeah, that's... Everyone needs to hear that. And... I guess if there was one piece of work that stood out to you as the best representation of you as a creative, you know, if someone's listening here and you want them to look up one thing about you, like what would you like to point them to?
My memes. No, no, don't look at my memes. I think it's Athera.
There's
a lot of love, a lot of work, a lot of passion went into that. It's something I've had an idea for more than 10 years. Like it's something that had been gestating like in my brain for a long time. And I think of things that are like actually like accessible, like that's definitely it.
And it is absolutely gorgeous. So
yeah, it's beautiful.
Check it out. Yeah.
Laura made me look at it.
Yeah.
Actually, just yesterday officially signed the artist of the comic book Heathen, Natasha Alterishi, to work for comics for some of the stuff I'm doing coming up.
That's awesome. More Athera?
Yeah,
more Athera.
Yeah. Oh. If you haven't read Heathen, like, it's fantastic. Like, go out comic store, pick it up. It's awesome.
Oh my god, that's so exciting.
Yeah.
Ooh, I can't wait. So when is future Athera stuff maybe projected someday to pop
in? I would say sometime in the fall at the latest. We have an adventure coming out soon. I'm supposed to finish that tonight, probably.
We're almost done. Don't worry.
Get it off to layout. So there'll be adventures coming out, and then a bigger book soon.
Ooh, I can't wait to sink my teeth into more. I'm doing the cat thing with my hands. Yeah.
Cat hands. Tune into this for cat hands.
Thank you so, so much, Bob. This is really fun. We both have the opportunity to interview a lot of our friends. You know, we know a lot of creatives and everything. And so it's just always cool because I know you really well, but I didn't know a lot of that, you know, like, and just hearing your perspective on stuff, it was illuminating and fun and wicked interesting. I know Jeff is like, can't wait to hear this episode. It's probably gonna be one of his favorite because he's a huge nerd too. So thank you so much, Bob. And
it was a pleasure.
We always end an episode with the three of us saying something together.
Show us your creative guts.
Thank you so much, Bob, for sitting down and chatting with us about all these nerdy endeavors that you do creatively. And I'm still just stunned by a lot of your projects, especially Athera. I think that was such a cool thing that you did, and I really encourage people to go check it out. If you want to learn more about Mr. Brooks and his creative pursuits, you can find him on the web, robert-brooks.com. His Twitter handle is a funky name you can find on our Facebook page, because I'm not going to say that out. And I really encourage you to check out Athera at atherarpg.com, which is AETHERARPG.com.
That was a lot.
Yeah.
You're such a champ.
Yeah. If that was hard and you don't want to like spell, just go to our Facebook and we'll have links there to all the awesome stuff that Bob produces and is involved with.
That's what our Facebook is there for. We're using it to help you better connect with our guests. And if you want to hear more episodes of Creative Guts, we are available on all major podcast platforms.
As always, we so much appreciate you listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode.
We'll see you next Wednesday.
I really encourage you to check out Athera at athera. Excuse me. Nope, I don't need to excuse me. So I'm gonna edit it.